Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Gail Seiler, together with Ursula Rudenberg.
Hi, Gail. We've worked together here at KHOI in the past few months, Gail, but this is the first time we're actually working together on Local Talk, so let's do it.
All right. Sounds good. I'm ready and excited to be co-hosting with you as well. This is a very busy time of year for people. Many of us are busy getting ready for the holidays, and at ISU, folks are extra busy now. Students are taking final exams and finishing projects, and professors have a lot of grading to do.
You would know that because you're involved at the university, so you're really aware of that. It does make it a time when it's easy to lose sight of events around us that are happening in the world.
That is so true. And our show today is designed just to address that, to connect with what's going on both locally and nationally.
Yep, that's the plan. In the second half of the show, we will be joined by Luke Jensen, who is with Res Development, the group that has turned the 1923 Roosevelt School into condominiums. The new homeless are moving in, and Luke will tell us about that. Mm-hmm. And we'll also hear from Sam Stagg and Jason Dietzenbach, who are from Hala Architecture, which is restoring the executive building just off Main Street in downtown Ames.
But first, on a more serious note, we will be hearing about demonstrations that have taken place recently on the ISU campus. Like so many locations across the country, there have been protests in response to the recent killings of black men at the hands of police and the fact that those police officers were not indicted for that. Discussions on campus began during the week after Thanksgiving. A grand jury delivered the decision to not indict the officer who killed Michael Brown. One public conversation was organized by the Office of Multicultural Student Affairs. Another public discussion was organized by student groups. When the killing of Eric Gardner also resulted in no indictment, activities at Iowa State increased, culminating in a die-in in the library and a march. I wanted to learn the reasons behind the demonstrations, so I interviewed several students who were involved with organizing those demonstrations. So we'll be hearing the voices of five ISU students, four undergraduate students, and one graduate student. We will hear Kia Carter and Lakeba Scott, president and vice president, respectively, of the ISU NAACP chapter, April Anderson, who is a doctoral student in the College of Human Sciences and a member of the Multicultural Greek Council. We'll also hear from two students active in the Black Student Alliance and the Men of Color Collective. They asked not to be identified. These students took time to let me interview them last week, even though it was finals week, and in some cases, they were squeezing it in between final exams. I'm very grateful to them for taking the time to do that and that we can share their voices with you. We began by talking about the actual demonstrations, their roles, and who organized the demonstrations. So let's listen to that.
There's a great amount of students that felt the need to participate and do something to show how we feel about the events that have happened in the United States so far. And so a collective group came together and staged a die-in. We all went in there into the atrium of the library, and we all laid on the ground for 4.5 minutes to signify the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown laid in the streets. And we had a silent protest on Friday where we marched around the campus and held signs.
We have been a part of a collective effort of many groups around campus to organize events such as the protests you saw Friday. You have the MSA, you have BSA. MSA is the Multicultural Student Affairs. BSA is a Black Student Association. You see groups from NSBE, that's the National Society of Black Engineers. You see a multitude of Hispanic groups. You see even administrators from various groups, the Black faculty, and even people of non-cultural organizations participating.
And the first day back from break, we had a discussion about it and how we were going to plan certain events to help out and notify the community of AIM. Before we went on Christmas break, we didn't want anyone to forget about it, so we kind of threw together the die-in at the library, which was the NAACP here and like other organizations on campus. And then that Friday, we held a silent protest just because of all the negative things that's been in the news about protests and rioting. We want to show that we do care, but we went about it a different way.
I'm also a member of Gamma Rho Lambda, and we're part of the MGC Council, the Multicultural Greek Council. And the MGC Council helped put together some of the protests last week on Dead Week. And so I felt it was part of my responsibility being on that council to participate, as well as the fact that I just have been a social justice advocate since I was a child. And so I felt important to speak up. My mother taught me as a child to, when you see injustice, to speak up and speak out. And if you don't, then you're participating in the injustice.
You're listening to Local Talk, and my co-host Gail Seiler is bringing us voices of students from Iowa State who organized demonstrations recently in response to the events in Ferguson and Staten Island, where police who killed black men were not indicted for juries, and they organized these demonstrations.
As you can hear through the interviews, Ursula, all the students stress how many campus groups came together to address these issues of racial injustice. This may not be an exhaustive list, but some of the groups that have been collaborating are the Black Student Alliance, the African Students Association, the National Society of Black Engineers, the Black Graduate Student Alliance, Men of Color Collective, Women of Color, National Pan-Hellenic Council, the Multicultural Greek Council, an organization of black faculty and staff, and the ISU chapter of the NAACP. A collaborative effort for sure.
Yeah.
I also asked the students about the reactions they've gotten to the demonstrations, and they described some very interesting responses from other people.
We pretty much had reactions on both ends. We've seen people that walked in not knowing of the demonstration and actively laid down with us during the 4.5 minutes, which was very powerful. And you'll even see people walking over some of the demonstrators, which was kind of a rude action if you looked at it through my eyes, you know, kind of just going about their merry way, not really acknowledging the fact that there are people there giving them space. So you kind of see, you know, smaller things like that. On social media, you've seen comments that kind of disturb people who are interested in this protest. You see comments like, oh, you guys are creating a fire hazard, you're in the way. What are you guys demonstrating about? And they say probably something that doesn't matter. So that's kind of the attitude that you see throughout, I don't want to say the Ames community, but definitely here on campus. A lot of college students not knowing what's going on in the media and not paying attention to what the real facts are and the real issues.
Well, we had both positive and negative, but I'll go with the positive first. So the Department of Residence gave all their employees time off during the protest so they can participate. And we had a lot of different people. It was also black students and other multicultural students, as well as Caucasian, that was out protesting with us. And then there's an app called Yik Yak where students can respond to what's going on around campus. And we had a lot of negative comments like, oh, it's just another way for black students not to do anything. Land in the library is in the form of protesting. And then there was also on a Facebook page called Ames People, where a lot of people were saying, like, there's no point in us protesting, and if we protest, they're going to protest our protest to stop it. And then a lot of people were just like, oh, why are you protesting this? He's a criminal. They had bad reputations. That's why it happened to them. Maybe if they listen to the police. Overall, we had a positive amount of feedback.
The first time I laid there, it was pretty quiet. Nobody really was walking around. They did it in segments, 4.5 minutes at a time, to represent the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown was lying on the street. And the second time I noticed, there was people asking questions, you know, what's going on? What's this all about? Things like that. And then I noticed at another time, a couple of people just walked right through the people that were laying down, stepped over people, completely disregarded. One person kind of snorted, putting my own perspective, but it sounded like, you know, snort of derision. But it seemed like most people were respectful and walking around. A number of people stopped to watch until we got up and then left.
Were you surprised at some of those responses?
I wouldn't say that I expected it. I was surprised at some of the kind of petty actions that I saw. You know, somebody stepped directly over my head during the demonstration, which I felt was, you know, pretty rude and pretty offensive to what was going on, the power of the movement. You don't want to think of things like that, but, you know, those things happen. But I don't think I really expected it.
I'd say the same. I was expecting some negative reaction, but not the large amount that we did see. You saw all on social media, because I know I looked right after to see, you know, if anyone was tweeting about it. Then there was a lot of negative comments. There were some positives there, which I did like, and I felt were really instrumental to the movement. But then there are also a lot of bad ones about, like he said before, you're in the way, and if you're in my way when I need to study, then I will step on you. When I saw that, when I was really taken back. Ultimately, I'd say it did catch me off guard, but not too off guard. I didn't think it would happen.
I'd like to say yes. The reality is no. No, I've seen so much in my life. I was not surprised.
I just want to say we also had people, like, I know I did, and I'm sure a lot of the other people on the exec board for the organizations had personal emails being sent to them about people wanting to get involved. So I had a couple of emails of some students wanting to get involved and seeing what they wanted to do. And also at the protest and the lay-in, there were students that came to me that wanted to get involved who didn't even probably know about the situation, but they wanted to see what they could do to help.
This is Local Talk, and you're hearing voices of ISU students who organized demonstrations at the university recently in response to the killings in Ferguson and Staten Island, where police who killed black men were not indicted by grand juries. KHOI reporter Gail Seiler interviewed them last week, and it sounds like the demonstrations have elicited some strong reactions from others, some hopeful and some kind of disappointing.
Yeah, they certainly did. The students also spoke about the larger issues that they feel need to be raised and evidenced by the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, Staten Island, and elsewhere. So let's hear more on that.
I think the biggest issue here is attacking a system that has been corrupt for years. You see these instances as, the more recent incidents, but these are things that have been going on for years. When you see something like this, you know, people won't think it's a big deal, or they'll kind of make excuses to why that happened. But this is a reoccurring issue. You think of numerous cases around this. You think of Rodney King in L.A. So what this movement is attacking is a system that has gotten used to that standard. This is a case of institutional racism, and it needs to be confronted, and it needs to be destroyed. So that's kind of one of the things that we want to do with this movement. It's going to be a very long process, and our purpose here on campus is to spread the word and let people know this is a serious issue and let them know why this is a serious issue. One of the biggest problems is people are ignorant about what is going on. You know, they just see this and see, well, you know, he got shot. It was self-defense by the officer. Mm-hmm. But no one deserves to get shot six times. I don't care what color you are. That didn't need to happen. There are steps he could have taken that would be more professional on the hands of a police officer.
So I know race is kind of like taboo in America. They don't want to talk about it because they feel like if they don't talk about it, it'll just solve itself, and that's not the case. In order to solve things, you have to talk about it. So a lot of people saying take race out of it. That's not why they were killed, but that's pretty much why. No one wants to really own up to say that's what happened, and it really is what happened. So I feel in order for everyone to come together as people, we need to talk about the problem in order to solve the problem.
I think also what needs to be addressed is the way that police officers handle certain situations. From my perspective, a lot of people, you know, they say, oh, he's a criminal, or he did this, or he did that. But personally, I feel if there was a Caucasian man, the situations would have been handled differently. So I feel like police, they're trained to de-escalate a situation or to get control of a situation before they just come out and draw their guns. So I feel like to, like, relook in on how they train police officers or they need to help police officers not react so fast. They're supposed to think about what they do before they do it. And I feel like with all of these situations, that's not being done. And also mainly because they are being profiled because they're black men. So, I mean, there's a video on Facebook of, they weren't police officers, they were security guards, but they were fighting three Caucasian boys, and they tried to get control of the situation while fighting them. But Eric Garner, or with Mike Brown, or even with Trayvon Martin and every other victim of this thing, they were just shot.
I do have a friend here. He was driving, and a police officer pulled him over. And the whole time he was talking to him, he had his hand on his gun. And it wasn't just, like, resting. It was more so, like, hand on the gun, like, finger on the trigger, ready to pull it. And they were talking to him, asking him, you know, could you take your hand off the gun? It's kind of making me nervous. He kept his hand right there. He pulled them over pretty much for no apparent reason. I feel like, too, they don't address the police. They don't hold them accountable. And I feel like they need to, otherwise it's going to keep happening. Hold them accountable, yes. Not all police officers are like the police who's doing these things, but they do represent all the other police officers. So unless you're going to need to address them and hold them accountable for what they're doing so it doesn't look bad on the police, and then you'll have a better trust and communication with the citizens and, like, the community and the police officers. But I feel like they don't want to do that. They just defend him. Oh, not everyone is bad, and there's just some bad cops, but he was just responding to how he was trained. Then maybe it's something wrong with the police training. You shoot till the target is neutralized. Like, how do you label a human as a target? No, we shoot till the threat is neutralized. So why is the threat greater when it's a black person than it is when it's a Caucasian? If you're going to shoot a black person because he threatened you or you felt threatened, why is it that you can calm a Caucasian person down? Or why is it that the guy who shot up the theater in Denver, how come he was apprehended and he shot so many people? How did you apprehend him? Why wasn't he shot to death and he'd already killed and injured so many people? And a lot of people want everybody to just forget that. Well, you know what? That was different. It's not a race thing. But if you look at everything that's been going on in the news, then every other black person just walking down the street, they're just killed so swiftly. Like, that's an issue, and it's pretty obvious. It's not a coincidence, and it keeps happening.
The students seem to agree that recent events are not isolated events, but part of a pattern of police violence that has been going on for a long time. They point to the systemic nature of these incidents and the deeply rooted biases and stereotypes they reveal. So I asked the students why they felt the need to get involved in this movement and what they think the demonstrations can accomplish. Like the last segment, they focused both on institutional changes that are needed, but they also have personal reasons.
I'm going to disclose I'm a white person. I actually struggled to come and do this interview because it's not my story to tell. But my story in this is to say we as white people need to use our privilege to step up and say this is not okay. Everybody matters. Black lives matter. None of this is okay. And so I'm using my privilege to say enough is enough. I really hope that not only law enforcement sees that their actions are really not okay, that other people see that the majority, the white people see that this is not okay and that we're done. We're done with people being treated unfairly. We're done with people being killed for their color. We're done with the racism. We're done. I also think that if enough people speak out and enough people speak up, that society itself will understand and that there will be policy changes. And I think that's what we're going for.
But I did have like a few professors that were, of course, Caucasian, and I'll have my hand raised in the class and they'll look directly at me and then look over it. And I ask people if I'm on like on the bus and it's like I'm the only open seat, no one else will come sit right there. So I feel like that's a problem, too. The justice system as a whole needs to be looked at. Everything in the country, I feel like, was founded on. It's not, they don't live up to how the country is built and what it was founded on. And I feel like that needs to be looked at.
You know, we're not saying that all policemen are bad. There are good policemen out there that protect the law and enforce the law to where everyone is treated fairly. So, you know, there are good police. But we've seen instances where there are bad police. And we believe that this is an institution that shouldn't have any flaws. It will have flaws, but the flaws that we see now are unacceptable in terms of America's creed. I don't want that to sound too poetic, but that's really what it comes down to. We have to call things out like this, and we have to work toward a change.
Although the students didn't cite specific statistics, there are some pretty stark data that support their concerns. For example, according to a recent ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black men are 21 times more likely to be shot and killed by police than young white men. That's a very shocking statistic. Other problems have also come to light as a result of these recent events and demonstrations. For example, the failure to indict the officers involved in these killings of black men has caused many to question the role of the district attorney in this judicial process. It seems pretty clear that racial stereotyping can permeate decision-making at many levels and with devastating results. I asked the students about the responses they've had from the university and other institutions, and they had some interesting comments.
So far in my courses, we haven't spoken of it at all. And really, I think we should, because an issue like this needs to be brought to the forefront, even if you're maybe for like 5 minutes or so. So we don't lose sight of what's actually happening. So it's not a problem of, I'm a math teacher, so I don't have to address this because it's not my problem. So I think it should be brought up, even in the smallest bit, it should be brought up in at least every class, so we can gain a bigger insight about what's going on, so we don't forget and lose sight of what's actually happening.
Last week, I spoke with the interim dean of the library, who was there supporting. I spoke with Thomas Hill, who was there supporting. I saw other faculty that were there supporting. So I think it is on the radar of the faculty as well.
I just wanted to say there's not enough conversation. One of the things that we are combating in this movement is the lack of talk about what's going on. You know, a lot of people, especially in smaller towns like Ames, tend to isolate this issue in a certain area. They say, oh, well, this doesn't really matter here. So, you know, why would we have to pay attention and protest about it? It doesn't affect us. But the reality is that it affects everyone here. You know, there's an injustice anywhere in America. We are the leader of freedom in the world. So, you know, we should really pay attention to things involving injustices to other people, especially minorities. But the conversation tends to die down when we don't talk about it enough. And then the situation becomes more insignificant as time moves along, and then it'll eventually disappear. So one of our purposes is to keep the conversation going and then continue to fight for a greater cause and for some change to happen within that system. So what we're trying to do is, you know, get a multitude of people on board with this. We have the backing of the administration here, faculty members. We have a multitude of organizations that are behind this. We want more people. We want people in the Ames community. We want, you know, older people. We want people that just don't really relate to it at all. We kind of want to change their minds. We even have the backing of the Ames police. That tells you that this is a very powerful movement, and he really supports us. I'm not going to name his name. If you know the chief, then you can ask him later. But a lot of people are supporting this, and that's kind of what we want. We want to keep the momentum going.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're hearing voices of Iowa State students who've been organizing demonstrations against the police killings of black men and the lack of legal response to punish them. My co-host, Gail Seiler, has been interviewing them at Iowa State and some very powerful ideas about injustice and how our nation can respond in order to be really a just land.
And they also had many ideas about how we in Central Iowa can move forward and connect with the movement on a national level. And that's what we'll hear in the last segment.
Right now, we're still in the planning process. We're still trying to work out all the kinks and make sure we abide by all the policies that we have here. We don't want to do anything that's going to make the movement look bad. We're going to continue planning over the break, and we're going to keep that network going in between all of the groups so we can know what's happening. And then at the coming of the year, we will announce new things we're about to do and try to get the support going again. We already have it now, and keep the ball rolling with more movements.
And you were going to organize something for this week, but then you couldn't because of finals, is that right?
I was informed, per Iowa State policy, we were not able to do that. And I'm glad that we were informed of that, because I want anything to throw dirt on this move. I don't want anything to set us back. So I want to make sure that we're following every rule to the T, so we're not doing anything that's outside of what we're supposed to be doing. Because if we do that, then all the naysayers are going to hound us even more, because we're already doing something that's against the grain.
Well, we did have some design students reach out to us about to help explain to the people who didn't understand why we felt it was so important. They were going to do, like, chalk outlines of people's bodies and put quotes inside of them. And then, like, they're going to take some of the responses that we got from Yik Yak with, like, all the people that was kind of racist comments. And so, like, they're going to put those in quotes as well and then answer the questions that they had inside of the body. So that's one thing, because we couldn't do it during finals. So we're going to do it next semester. And then, too, we're going to try to collaborate with other chapters of the NAACP. Like, I have a friend in Dubuque. And then we're going to try to get involved with some that's in Des Moines as well and try to bring something else. Not just for these cases, but just trying to figure out how we can promote unity among the people and stop this, like, negative image of, like, black people, like, men and women alike. And just trying to get people to read all the profile and they do all the biases that they have by coming together. So we want to do it first within, like, our organizations come together and then try to bring the community in as well so we can not have this, oh, I don't want to sit by this person because he's black.
I'd just like to say keep your ears and eyes open to more events to come, because this movement is going to keep going. Naysayers are going to, it's not going to get any better for them, because you're going to keep hearing about it. So I would just say keep an open mind to what's going on and really try to learn the facts behind the movement and learn what's going on in the community. Because, you know, these people that are a part of this movement are a part of the community and therefore should be addressed as members of such.
I want to say thank you again to these ISU students who took time to share their thoughts on the recent killings by police. They certainly do have a vision for where they want the movement to go and how best to accomplish that. They want to find people outside of ISU who share their concerns about racial injustice, so this was an opportunity to spread their message to you, our listeners. During the break, we're going to play a song from the Civil Rights Movement. I hope the ISU students we heard today won't mind me reaching back in history to share the voices of young people who went before them. We'll hear a song called This Little Light, performed by a trio of high school students who were involved in student demonstrations in Montgomery, Alabama in 1960.
Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Oh, deep down in the south, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, deep down in the south, I'm gonna let it shine.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, hosting your Local Talk program today, together with Gail Seiler. And the music we just heard was This Little Light, sung by three high school students from the Civil Rights Movement in Selma, Alabama. And prior to that, we were listening to the thoughts and feelings of Iowa State students in response to the recent killings by police in Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York. Gail has been with us for now about 4 months, bringing us voices and ideas from Iowa State. And we thank you, Gail. It's really great to have that added to our team. We really appreciate what you're doing for Local Talk.
I appreciate the opportunity. We hope to continue to listen to responses to recent events and to allow a platform for many people to be heard on them,
that including
sounds good. The ISU students.
That sounds really good.
Shifting gears a bit, we have two guests in the studio right now. Sam Stagg and Jason Dietzenbach are soon going to be our neighbors here downtown. They are with HALA Architecture Structural Planning is the official name. HALA will be making the building at 413 Kellogg Avenue their new office space. That address is what is known as the Executive Building, next to Bicycle Plus on the block just north of Main Street.
Welcome, Sam. Welcome, Jason.
Welcome. Good morning. Thank you very much.
HALA Architecture Structure Planning was recently awarded a $75,000 grant for the remodeling of its future office. The grant was one of 13 Main Street, Iowa grants awarded in October by the Iowa Downtown Resource Center and Main Street, Iowa program. This statewide program is sponsored by the Iowa Economic Development Authority. The grant program started in 2002 through an appropriation from the Iowa legislature. It's a challenge grant, a matching grant, in other words, so it leverages state and federal funds with private reinvestment. Since 2002, 97 projects have been funded in 42 Iowa cities and now Ames.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we were pretty excited to get the grant. It really is a great catalyst for the rest of our projects, so we were pretty excited about that.
Do you know how many grants were given this year?
I think it said 13 on some of the documentation I've read. And so we are lucky to be one of those 13.
And you're the only ones from Ames, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Ames can only support one project, and this was the project that Ames chose.
So we feel pretty fortunate and lucky, to tell you the truth. It's quite an honor to receive such a huge grant in our perspective to help us out.
So tell us a little bit about AILA.
Yeah, the company is nearly 30 years old. John AILA has been the president from that time. He purchased it from the previous owner in, I believe, 1986, and it's had a handful of names since then. It was in Boone, Iowa for nearly 25 years. And then we moved to Campus Town, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. I've lost track now. And so we were excited to be a part of Campus Town and what was going on there. And so we kind of dove into the culture of Campus Town. And John was elected the president of the CAA, the Campus Town Action Association. And a few of us also got on other boards throughout the city and Leadership Ames, a few of us went through. And so we really just kind of dove into what the community is doing and being very open with our use of our gifts and talents and abilities, not just for our own personal growth in our business, but to really wanting to dive into the community and help the community any way we could. And so we were part of a lot of boards and things and helping out with.
You were involved recently with the New Ideas for Campus Town, right? Making the idea book?
Correct. Yeah, that was a fun project. We were teamed up with the city. With Jeff Benson with the city and also with Kim Hanna. She's the executive director for the Campus Town Action Association. And so that was a lot of fun, that project. Yeah, so we were in Campus Town for the longest time and then we got word that there was some development going on. And so we started to look for a different place. And things in Campus Town just weren't working out for us. We looked for a few things, but it was difficult to really land on anything. And finally, this opportunity at 413 Kellogg opened up, and we just got really excited about it. Everything seemed to kind of fit in terms of our scheduling and the dollars we were thinking about spending. And then when the grant finally came through, or the opportunity came up, and we did all this work to get the grant, and then finally getting it was just a great, I guess, validation to all the work and the effort we've gone through.
So things are going your way.
Yeah, seemingly. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Things are going our way. We're excited. We're a growing firm, and there's 13 of us right now. And
what kind of commissions does the firm take?
We do everything from small-scale commercial to large-scale industrial.
Do you do private homes?
Not too many private homes. We've done a handful of private homes. We do a lot of multifamily housing, student housing, primarily in central Iowa, but we're excited to expand maybe our borders a little bit too.
What was the building that you're going to be refurbishing and making your own?
It started as a bank built in 1941 and has some semblance to the Art Deco design era of the mid-20th century. And so it started as a bank, and just so it's a really big open space where it had a large teller room and a couple different smaller offices. So that's how it started. And then it was purchased by a different owner, and it was kind of broken up into smaller office suites. A lot of walls were put up, a lower ceiling was put in, and really kind of destroyed the character of the interior. And they needed it for that particular purpose,
sure.
So it's justifiable, you know. But we're anxious to really go into there and bring it back to its original grandeur, so to speak. You know, open up the space again. There's approximately a 50 by 50 feet area on the floor by 16 foot tall ceiling that we're really excited to bring back to and use that as our studio space.
You're going to restore it to how it was originally?
Pretty close.
There's a handful of things that have been done over the years. The windows have been replaced. They're now aluminum windows. So there's certain things that we're not going to go and replace right now. Those are functioning well. Maybe down the road, do something that would be more original in character. Same with the entry doors. I think we're going to replace them, but probably not back to the full extent. The vestibule and some of the molding around the ceiling where the walls meet, there's kind of an Art Deco stream cornice running around the room. We're going to be restoring that. There's significant water damage in several areas to that and plasterwork in general. And there's also a terrazzo floor that's underneath some of the carpet and or layers of flooring, I guess, in some areas. So,
can you explain what a terrazzo floor is?
Go ahead.
It's a ground stone.
You see terrazzo flooring in a lot of old schools. It's a very durable product. It's a cementitious matrix, if you will, that holds a bunch of ground stones together. Often marble is used.
Oh, like our floors here.
the Pantorium.
Yeah. And then once that's first laid and it sets up almost like a concrete mix, you take a grinder, you literally grind the few fractions of an inch off the top surface and it becomes really smooth. And you take a polisher and you polish it. Mm-hmm. And it's literally a stone and concrete type floor that almost lasts forever.
So you're in a way going to simulate the feeling at least of what the building used to be like, even if it's not the exact original.
Yes, and generally you walk in, there's kind of an entry vestibule, and then it opens up to the large volume of space that Sam was talking about.
And that'll be a studio space for you?
And that will be a studio space.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The building really lends itself to a studio environment. You walk in and there'll be a conference room off to one side flanking the entry and then a couple of smaller offices off of the other side, which are going to be in the exact same locations as the original office spaces. And then when you walk in, it's an axial entry and it opens up to this huge 50 by 50 foot volume with 16 foot tall space. So we're going to take it back to that. And so that's how we work. We have a couple of conference spaces. There's a couple of private offices. And then the majority of the staff are working in the studio environment just for that creative, collaborative environment and workspace.
The grant that you got, is it for the inside of the building or is it for the facade of the building?
Go ahead, Jason.
It's a combination of both. We received a facade grant for Ames downtown area, and right now there's kind of it was a walk-up window at one point, and then they replaced that with a door on the north, and that's going to be right in the middle of the studio space, and that's not original, and you can see where there's water damage as well, and that's not original, and so we're going to be taking that back to the original facade of just being a window. There's seven large windows. They're 4 foot by 9 foot high along the north, so it's going to be great north lighting. And then, again, the front entry as well that is not original, and so we're going to be replacing that entry.
Well, thank you so much for coming and telling us about this, and welcome to the neighborhood.
Great. Thanks. We're excited to be here.
And since now you're just an alley away from us, please come again and keep us updated on how the building's going and just what's happening on your end of the block.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Jason Dietzenbach and Sam Stagg from Hala Architecture Structural Planning.
Structure planning, that's
correct. Structure planning.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
You.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Radio. I'm Gail Seiler, here with Ursula Rudenberg, and the music we just heard was Winter Solstice by Ralph Towner.
And it is the winter solstice.
That's
Saturday.
Right,
Saturday
yeah.
was the shortest day of the year.
And they're getting longer.
Yeah, now it's going to get cold.
Before the break, we were talking about the restoration underway for the executive building on Kellogg in downtown Ames. And continuing with the theme of renovating old buildings,
the move into the Roosevelt has started. So we brought in somebody to talk to us about that. That's the former Roosevelt School. The website of the newly renovated building describes it as a historic adaptive reuse project. Located in the heart of Ames, this stunning 1923 school building has been reimagined into 20 single-family condominium homes.
And Luke Jensen from Res Development is here with us to tell us what's happening. Is it Res Development or RES Development?
It's actually RES Development.
Aha. Okay. And welcome, Luke.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Sure. Welcome, Luke. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. So what is RES Development then?
RES Development is our development arm of our real estate firm, something that was designed specifically for adaptive reuse projects such as the Roosevelt. It's a way for us to bring a certain skill set that's a little bit different than our other side, which is in the management of properties.
And who is we when you refer to us?
Yeah. RES is a family-owned and operated business. It started by my father, Dean. I think as you can see at the Roosevelt, with the type of project that is, it requires really intense and hands-on building practices, and that's a gift that he has, and I've been able to participate in working alongside and seeing that building come from an idea to, like you guys just said, people moving in and seeing Christmas trees, and it's a real neat project to be a part of.
RES is a development company.
Mm-hmm.
Is it focusing on renovations, or do you do new developments as well?
We do a little bit of both. Being a smaller company, we kind of focus on one at a time. And we've got aspirations to diversify a little bit into other disciplines inside the real estate industry, new construction, commercial, industrial. But we're kind of selective in how we approach that.
How long has the rebuilding of the Roosevelt been going on?
The planning started in October of 2012. Mm-hmm. And so we did our due diligence and study of the building, determining its viability for housing. And then the environmental work took place last summer, summer of 2013, and then the construction in earnest started about a year ago. The first thing of value we added back to the building was windows, and those came in November of 2013.
And have you changed the outside of the building?
We did add a 25-car garage and atrium on the north end of the building, so that's all new. But as far as the 1923, and then the school district did an addition in 1968 on the north end, that's all been restored and preserved. And we did a tuck pointing and washing of the building to bring back its masonry life and kind of restore that look.
It looks like there's balconies now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a balcony for every unit?
We have 11 total balconies. As mentioned, there's 20 units. Mm-hmm. About half have a balcony accessible there.
Some of them are larger, some of them are smaller.
Yeah. Just to give a little profile, there's 3 1-bedrooms, 10 2-bedrooms, and then 7 3-bedrooms. And they vary in square footage from about 900 square feet on the smaller end, and we have units that'll be exceeding 2,200 square feet.
When you take a school building like that, are you using the classroom spaces, or did you just gut it and start over?
The way that the Roosevelt was constructed is built on a column and beam system that was in place, and so those were kind of our boundaries of how we could use the space. So the way that the school was originally built, the classrooms do line up pretty well for residential space, and you also have considerations with your light and windows. And I think that's one of the nice features at the Roosevelt is the amount of glass or window opening that was there, and to bring that back, the units have incredible amount of natural light coming into them. Just the volume and scale of those units is pretty impressive.
So is one classroom one apartment?
At times it is, yeah. And then then there might be 2 or 3 classrooms and a bathroom become another unit. So, you know, in that type of building, there's so much common space of hallways and staircases. And that was a fun exercise of how to participate and engage those different design elements and challenges and make them desirable that people wanted to be there and live in that type of space. So.
Are there any chalkboards in the apartments?
We did, yeah. We've incorporated chalkboards.
Really?
Yeah. One of the things that was important is important to know is that the school had so much character and so much natural building material already there mm-hmm. that before we took down walls, we took out baseboard, case, chalk rail, picture rail, crown molding, chalkboard holders, and mm-hmm. chalkboards took lots of different things out. An original water fountain came out and put back in. So we rescued and took out a lot of wood and a lot of material, refurbished it, restored it, brought it right back in. And there's places that you would never know that was any different, that mm-hmm. there was never anything but the original wood.
Did the school have a gymnasium?
It did, yeah.
And what did you do with the gymnasium?
Well, that was another unique design consideration or element that we worked through. So the gym had 22-foot ceiling, and we wanted to line it up so we could get just a hallway through there and then additional living space. So we floated a new floor across that gym to create two units or two spaces in the midpoint of the gym.
Meaning two floors?
Two 11-foot floors, basically.
Yeah.
So the gym now is how many apartments?
The gym is four wow. apartments, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How does it look? How does it feel to you?
It's really rewarding to see, you know, and it's just happened in the last 2 weeks that you work for a year and a half on a project to the point where you get it ready for somebody to live in there. There's only a few hours that you can have where it's completely done. Mm. There's no more work that you have to do to that specific space. And then in just a few hours, you sell it to somebody. And so that's a emotionally up and down because it's something you've poured a lot of energy and effort into. And yet it's not yours
just for
any longer.
A few hours, yeah. It's yours.
Yeah. So it's been fun to drive by now. You see Christmas lights and trees in the window spaces. Mm. It's neat to see residents.
So people have moved in now.
They have, yeah, just in the last 2 weeks. So,
mm-hmm. Any responses?
Well, we're getting a lot of positive feedback from the residents and the owners that just love being in that space. And it's neat to be able to meet somebody's expectations as far as the living space. And so feedback's been really positive from our owners. We have six more units that are in kind of in the finish phase, and those will be trying to wrap those up here towards the end of January. We're looking forward to finishing out, being out of the building as far as construction. This spring we'll have some landscaping and some finishing to do. We're going to work alongside the City of Ames, the park there, to create that boundary and that space. So it's a real collaborative effort on the city park and in the private lands of the Roosevelt.
Have all of the units already been bought?
Not all of them. There's six that are still available for, mm-hmm. for sale. Our marketing efforts have been pretty grassroots. They've just been mm-hmm. the website that you guys mentioned and just starting to meet people in the community. Or some of the buyers have come from the Roosevelt and Old Town neighborhood that are looking for more of a maintenance-free lifestyle mm-hmm. and don't want to move out. They love Ames's urban core and being able to get close to the services and downtown, and it's a great location and a real neat neighborhood. So we've enjoyed being a caretaker of Roosevelt over the last year and a half and feel like that building is set up for success in the future.
Is there any common space in the building?
There is. With 20 units, it's not overly amenity heavy, but I think it's pretty practical with what we've done. We have an on-site conference room that the association will be able to use. There's a small fitness room there that the residents will be able to utilize. And then the building sits on almost 2 acres. And so along the east side especially, we've allocated green space. And really, if you take it into the park, it becomes a pretty nice, visually real attractive open space that the residents can use. There's a designation for flower beds and some garden space on the east side as well.
Will people be able to have any kind of vegetable garden outside? Might there be space for that?
Yeah,
community gardens kind of thing?
Sure. With most of the project, our position has been to allow the association to make those decisions, the owners of the Roosevelt. And so mm-hmm. We've designated space for that. And certainly, based on the owners and the conversations I've had, I'd expect that there would be some of that to take place on site there.
Well, I'd love to see the inside. Maybe I'll have to pretend I'm going to buy a unit and come to a tour.
There might be a little bit of that going on. We've been speaking with Luke Jensen from RES Development, who's here to tell us about the move into the Roosevelt. And that about does it for Local Talk. I've been one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Gail Seiler.
Thanks, Luke, for being here.
Thank you, Luke.
Thanks a lot.
Today we heard a variety of things. We heard responses to the recent killings by police in Missouri and New York from 4 undergraduate students and 1 graduate student at ISU. Kia Carter, president of the ISU NAACP chapter, Lakeba Scott, vice president of the ISU NAACP chapter, April Anderson, a doctoral student in the College of Human Sciences and member of the Multicultural Greek Council, and 2 students who preferred not to use their names that are active in several organizations on campus, such as the Black Student Alliance and Men of Color Collective.
We also heard from Sam Stagg and Jason Dietzenbach from HALA Architecture Structural Planning, which is restoring the executive building in downtown Ames as their new offices.
And Luke Jensen from RES Development described renovations that have occurred at the old Roosevelt School and the move-in that is now underway into what is now called the Roosevelt. Local Talk was engineered today by Richard Morrison. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron. Remember to tell your out-of-town friends and family that KHOI is now streaming live online at khoifm.org so they can share our little piece of Central Iowa. Please remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations make it all possible.
And please remember to join KHOI by the end of this year. Membership is $40, with premium membership is $100, but we will gladly accept any donation you make. If you can be a sustaining member with a donation of $250 or more, we would like to hear from you. Our goal by January is $40,000, and at this point, we've received $29,000, so we have $11,000 to go. Thank you if you've already donated, and we are very appreciative of your support and excited about doing community radio in 2015 with you. As always, your participation is what makes KHOI possible.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Again, thank you for donating. See you again on the radio.